Blog Talk Radio.
That the fate of the universe is placed in the hands of these children?
They're teenagers, somewhere between infancy and full maturity. It's hard to explain, really.
Show me the coins. The morphing grid is never wrong. If the power coins have returned to the ship with these teenagers, then these teenagers are the Power Rangers.
Okay, quick question. Did I just hear you say we're Power Rangers?
Yes. Yes, you are the Power Rangers. Any other questions?
No, I think I'm good.
Good.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinema Royale. I am Travis Hobson of the Punch Drunk Critics, and that clip you just heard was obviously from Power Rangers, and that was the voice of Bryan Cranston as Zordon. The interesting thing about that is Bryan Cranston once suited up as one of the monsters in the original Power Rangers way back in the day. So he's kind of come full circle in a sense. But we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes with my buddy Jeff Lyles of Lyles Movie Files. Presumably he knows more about the Power Rangers than I do, because I did not watch the show that much when I was younger. I thought it was corny and cheesy, which I guess are some of the things people like about it. But back then I was not all that interested. So we'll have Jeff in here to talk about it. And I actually don't know what he feels about the movie. I know he was at the screening with me, but I haven't talked to him about it. So I don't know if he liked it or not. We'll find out in just a few minutes. Later on in the show, I'll also be talking about Terrence Malick's latest Song to Song. And I will give my thoughts on Mr. Malick, who is a director that, well, I used to love quite a bit. And, not so much anymore. And I will talk about that in just a little while. Terrence Malick, whatever. Also, I want to thank everybody who checked out my interview with Danny Boyle. That is up on the site right now. Go to blogtalkradio.com/cinemaroyale, or you can find it at punchdrunkcritics.com. I had a chance to spend about 15 to 20 minutes with Danny Boyle to talk about T2 Trainspotting. That was my second time talking to Boyle. I talked to him about 7 or 8 years ago for 127 hours. He had a lot of things to say. It's been 21 years since the original Trainspotting. And as you can imagine, a lot has changed. He talked about reuniting the cast, Ewan McGregor, Ewan Bremner, Robert Carlyle, and Johnny Lee Miller, and everybody kind of finding their groove again. So we got to talk about that. So check out that interview if you have not done so already. Do that here at blogtalkradio.com or at punchdrunkcritics.com. And of course, be sure to check out all of the shows on Critical, the Movie Critics Network, which you can find on Facebook and also on Blog Talk Radio. And after that, you know, we got Blu-rays, we got news, a lot of news coming up this week. Robert Rodriguez, an Escape from New York remake, some news on Adam Sandler, Brett Ratner's Guy Beef of Rotten Tomatoes, I'm filling in on that. And I'm going to talk about why I think Sony is about to screw Spider-Man up all over again. They screwed him up once already, and now they seem like they're going back to doing the same things that didn't work before, which is weird. You would think they would have learned a lesson, but it doesn't seem as if they did. So we're going to talk about that later on this show. That's a lot for an hour show. We'll see if I can breeze through it a little bit quickly. Assuming Jeff calls in here on time, which hopefully he will. He should be calling in here right about now. If he doesn't, then I'll just talk about Power Rangers myself. And then I will spend the rest of the show damning him for not showing up. Nah, Jeff should be here, hopefully. We'll find out in just a minute. So, lots of other stuff going on here as well. Lots of other movies came out this week besides Power Rangers and besides Song of the Song. It was Life, which is the new sci-fi film with Jake Gyllenhaal, Rebecca Ferguson, and Ryan Reynolds. This is a reunion, actually, for Reynolds because he was working with his Deadpool writers on this film, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick. I was actually surprised that Sony didn't talk more about that. They didn't hype that aspect of the film up. And if you, I don't know if you saw the box office, you can find it at punchdrunkcritics.com as well. Life did not start off so well, only opening with $12 million for the $58 million film. Maybe they should have played up the Deadpool connection a little bit more, and that might have helped them a great deal. I think it would have. So, anyway, Jeff is here. So, let's talk about Power Rangers. What's up, Jeff?
What's up, man? How you doing today?
I'm all right, man. How you doing?
I can't complain. You know, March Madness is winding down, and it's a nice Sunday, so I'm relaxed.
All
set
to
talk about Power Rangers.
I haven't watched a single moment of NCAA basketball, which is, you know, I used to be huge. March was my favorite time of the year, and now I'm so busy now that I don't get a chance to watch anything anymore. It kind of sucks. If it's not wrestling, then I don't get to watch it anymore. Kind of sucks.
Oh, I understand.
I know.
This tournament has been pretty good though. I've been really,
really?
Impressed.
It's Isn't Gonzaga in the Final Four or something?
Yeah, they made it in. Oregon's made it in, and Xavier had a nice run after they pulled off a nice upset to beat a 3 and a 2. So it was pretty. It's been fun.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Nice buzzer beaters. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I need to try and get back into college basketball next year because I do miss it. But anyway, let's talk about Power Rangers. Now, I don't know, how familiar are you with Power Rangers? Were you a fan of it back in the day?
You know, I was like, that was probably the last kind of throwback show from the old cartoons, you know, when I grew up, like watching G.I. Joe, Transformers, Masters of the Universe, and all those. And it was not nearly like that, but it was like, okay, this is something to watch after school and watch some, you know, cheesy action or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I watched the first couple of seasons. I couldn't tell you what happened on which episode. I watched it. I knew it was corny, but, you know, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I watched it, like, off and on. Like, I watched an episode here, an episode there. I couldn't tell you the storylines or any of the particular characters, except for maybe Tommy, who the Green Ranger / White Ranger. I think he's been every Ranger at some point, one point or another. I could probably tell you a little bit more about him, but for the most part, I don't know the whole chronology of Power Rangers. I don't know the whole lineage. I don't know all that stuff. So I kind of going into this Power Rangers, I would say, with a fairly clean slate. Now, unlike your buddy and mine, Julian Lytle, who is a feverish fan of the Power Rangers, you know, he goes in there with a ton of fan baggage. So as expected from our buddy Julian, he was not a big fan of the movie because it changes so much stuff. But I actually walked out of this actually thinking it was okay. Now, this version of Power Rangers is directed by Dean Israelite, and I commented in my review that he looks like he graduated from the Michael Bay School of Excess, which, you know, he did direct Project Almanac, which is a Michael Bay-produced film, which is the same as Jonathan Liebsman directing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for Michael Bay, who produced it. All these guys have a style that looks like Michael Bay, light. And I think Israelites is like that too, especially when you look at some the designs of the Power Rangers, which they look like robots rather than humans in suits, which I don't think is an upgrade. And like the Zords and things like that are bulky and they got extra stuff on them they don't need. And it just, you know, it's the Michael Bay school of more is better, which, you know, that's fine. Now, I actually like this Power Rangers, despite the fact that I think it takes a little too long to get going. But what I really enjoyed about it was the fact that we spent a lot of time getting to know the characters. This movie is probably about 75% training and all that sort of thing. But, you know, they make the teamwork aspect seem really important because it is in Power Rangers more so than most other movies. The teamwork aspect is important. So when they do finally become a team, I think the movie does a good job of making that, you know, seem relevant. But overall, in the long haul, I think it's still takes a little too long to really get going. But what did you think of Power Rangers, Chef?
I don't like it as much as you do. But I think what a common thing with a lot of people, I really liked how they played up the teams. I thought their chemistry was great, and I liked how they played off each other. And I was really invested in them becoming the Power Rangers.
Right.
And like the movie,
that's
like 2 hours
benefit of taking
long,
so much time.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they kind of had this serious tone, so they when they shifted off to the action, it was like, whoa, what are y'all doing now? I felt like they even needed to go all in kind of Power Rangers goofy or kind of keep that same action tone or, you know, more serious tone throughout, you know, once they started getting into that fight, because it did this whole 180 when they went to that. Like, all of a sudden, they were martial arts experts. They knew how to pilot these things, and was like, okay. And I think they needed to do a little bit more on that.
I wrote something similar in my review, was that they, you know, for most of the movie, it was very much like Chronicle, which is sort of a realistic, sort of a darker version of that story, of that origin, superhero origin. But then once they formed into a team, they tried to have it both ways and play up the nostalgia aspect. I mean, that's when we get like 10 seconds of the Go-Go Power Rangers theme. I was like, why are we just getting that now? And it's like, why even, if you're only going to give us that much, why do it at all?
Right.
You know?
It didn't flow at all with how they had set it up, which was, you know, if they wanted to keep it serious, I would have been on board with it, but it went so far to the left of what they had established. It was like, whoa, this isn't what you guys had set us up for.
Yeah, they even shot the movie different during that part too, because that was when we saw them kind of do like the TV show did, which is pull back so you can see these big martial arts battles with those putty monsters, you know, and that's kind of the way they did it on the TV show. And it was always sort of silly on the TV show. It didn't really jive with the tone of the movie though.
No. It was weird because it felt like watching Elizabeth Banks and all of her scenes. She was all in with the old school Power Rangers. Like she was, like
she
living
was
it
really
up and
hamming it up as Rita Repulsa.
Yeah, she was all on board. And I was like, you know, she got the memo. Everybody else was like, all right, let's do this Power Rangers movie serious, and we're gonna treat it respectfully and all this. But she was like, I'm gonna have fun. And then when those two movies came together, it was like, what's happening here?
Yeah, it was interesting because the movie starts off really dark, and I thought that opening shot it looked like it was taken exactly from that Power Rangers short movie. Remember that from a couple of years ago?
Oh yeah.
That Power Rangers short that was dark and kind of violent and it got people talking about Power Rangers again. I really think that movie that short is what inspired them to start making this movie. I think that kind of the fervor that created, because that opening shot with the helmet laying on its side, you know, was almost shot for shot exactly like that. So I wonder if that was their way of kind of paying homage to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Did you know, it's one of those properties where a lot of people have seen it over the years, and it's like, oh yeah, I remember Power Rangers. And I'm curious what this one's going to be like, because I feel like they try to please every fan base with it, as opposed to just creating a new generation of Power Rangers fans and kind of letting that be the new thing. So I think that's kind of where they messed up, because it's like, you can't have Power Rangers both ways. You can't go serious, you can't go funny or goofy in the same kind of movies.
Right. One of the good things I think one of the good things that come out of them spending so much time building up the characters is that, you know, if this franchise does continue, and based on the opening weekend where it had $40 million, $59 million worldwide, which is a pretty good start, it seems like they might be willing to move forward on a sequel already, probably. But they want to make it a 6-movie franchise, which I think is insane. to even start thinking that way. Is that one of the good things is that they know they no longer have to go through all that exposition and stuff like that anymore in the next movies. You agree?
Oh, definitely. In my review, I wrote that while I had issues with this one, I think the sequel can improve on it because they don't have to set everything up and they can just go into continuing that fun dynamic between the Rangers, maybe showing off some new stuff and having them learn something new. But just that whole initial getting to know you phase is out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, I do see something where this is following sort of the same pattern as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, another nostalgia property, which started off its franchise. It started off with a movie that I don't think was very good. It was okay, you know, like just sort of like how I feel about this one. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. And then the second movie came out, and I think the second Ninja Turtles movie was a vast improvement over the first.
Oh, definitely.
And yet, it underperformed, and that was pretty much the end of everything. I mean, there's a lot of curiosity that goes into the first movies of anything, and if they don't win everybody over, then that's almost the end of it. That kills off your audience of people who were casual. It kills off your audience of people who were big fans and now are disappointed. I think I kind of feel like there's potential for that to happen again if they try to go forward on the second movie.
Yeah, but I feel like I don't think this was like that Turtles one because I hated that first Turtles movie and I really liked the second one. I feel like this one is enough of like, okay, I see where you're going. I feel like more people are going to be willing to give it a chance. Like, okay, let's see what you guys do with this second one. Because I feel like most people can kind of see that they were spending a lot of time building the characters up. And maybe from Marvel movies, they're now like, okay, I understand you got to set it up. Let's see what you do on the next one.
Right. But the thing is, the second Ninja Turtles movie gave fans everything they wanted to see. Bebop, Rocksteady, Krang, all this stuff that we were dying to see. The second Power Rangers movie is already promising fans exactly the Ranger they've been dying to see, which is the green/white Ranger Tommy. They're already promising that stuff, so it seems like they're going down the same path, and I don't know if that's necessarily the right way to go. But I mean, it's tough to say. It's tough to say.
Yeah, but I think the Turtles movie.
You hated the first Turtles. I didn't hate it.
I hated the designs because they made them look kind of like monsters, and I didn't think that was the right way to go for something that's more goofy and fun-loving. Power Rangers don't have a uniform look, and they kind of switch with every iteration of them. So it's like, okay, this is the 2017 version of the Power Rangers. Yeah, maybe a little bit more alien, a little bit more robotic, but okay. And then, you know, they can switch up for the next movie. They're not set with – I mean, the Turtles have to look that way for those movies. The Rangers can switch up with each movie. Got to sell those toys.
Right. No, yeah, they're definitely going to change some stuff up because they are going to merchandise the hell out of this thing as best they can. I was thinking about the actors who played the Power Ranger in this movie. I'm a big fan of R.J. Kyler, who played the Blue Ranger. He was, of course, from Me and Earl and the Dying Girl and those cigarette commercials where he tells you not to smoke. Right, the truth commercials where he's getting like dragged out of his prom because he needs to go smoke. I don't know if he made those commercials before Me and Earl and the Dying Girl or not, but he's in them. I really like him. He plays his character's. He says he's on the autism spectrum, and I guess he kind of he played that part pretty well. I was a big fan of Naomi Scott, who played the Pink Ranger. I think she's if anybody's going to break out of this cast, it might be her. It may be Ludi Lin who plays the Ranger.
He was the one that was Black Ranger.
Black Ranger.
I really liked him. He was the one who was like, oh, he's cool. He's a cool character, and with he had a bit more sympathetic story arc than some of the other ones.
He did.
Like,
okay, yeah.
See why he's doing what he's doing. He's living life because it's not promised. And, he just had a more fun aspect that maybe some of the other Rangers didn't have because they were a little bit too serious.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do next. I don't know if this franchise has 6 movies in it. That seems wildly ambitious. That's crazy ambitious. But at least one more, I would say, and then we'll see how that goes from there. Any final thoughts on Power Rangers, Jeff?
I'm actually looking forward to the sequel. Like, I think they can fix all the issues I had with the first one. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think of that for every franchise starter film. But this one, the things that they did not get right, I think they can improve on.
Yeah. All right. Did you see any other movies this week that you make a quick comment on before you go?
No. Nothing. Yeah, no. That was it. That's the one I caught this week.
That's the only one we caught this week? Is that just Power Rangers?
Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah. Hey, man, right. I wish I had the time to do it, but I can't watch all the March Madness games and then get up at the crack of dawn and catch all the movies at night. So.
All right, man. All right, man. Well, everybody go check out Jeff's site, lylesmoviefiles.com. He's got more than movies over there. I think he's got like toys and other kind of crap over there too. So you got all sorts of stuff going on over there. But I appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot for coming
anytime,
on.
Anytime, man. All right,
man. Talk to you later.
Cool. All right, bye.
All right, that's Jeff Lyles of Lyles Movie Files. Go check his site out. Like I said, he's got movies, he's got TV, he's got action figures. He's always unboxing toys over there and stuff. So we're gonna take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about Terrence Malick's new film, Song to Song, and why I'm really starting to hate that guy as a director. We'll be right back. I bet you could imagine that scene that you just heard right there from Terrence Malick's Song to Song. I bet you could picture it in your head. It's Ryan Gosling and Rooney Mara. It's Gosling basically trying to hit on Mara's character. I bet you could imagine in your head the camera swooping around, following them over their shoulders, you know, with them looking at each other fleetingly. Oh. But, you know, that's pretty much all of Terrence Malick's movies at this point. Song to Song is his latest film. And this one is set against the backdrop of the Austin music scene. Now, this movie has been in the works for years. The very first images that came out from it, because I remember he took them, he shot some footage at the Austin Music Festival a few years ago. And the first images featured Christian Bale and Haley Bennett. So we all assumed that they were going to be the stars for obvious reasons. It's Christian Bale and Haley Bennett. And they're the first images. Why wouldn't they be? But of course, Terrence Malick is a director who does his own thing. And in typical Malick fashion, the stars that you thought were in the movie aren't in the damn movie at all. Christian Bale and Haley Bennett make no appearances in Song to Song. They are completely cut out. But that's the way Malick works. He did the same thing with Knight of Cups, that god-awful film that he dropped on our heads last year. And Song to Song is essentially the same movie as Knight of Cups, whereas Knight of Cups was about the Hollywood lifestyle and excesses of that. Song to Song is about the music industry and the same exact problems. All of Malick's movies at this point seem to revolve around characters who are involved in fleeting relationships. Deals with lust and all these sorts of things, and betrayal and greed, and but there's no actual storylines to any of them. And Song to Song is no different. Song to Song has no actual storyline going through it. Yeah, you have Mara's character, who is a secretary slash wannabe guitarist. Ryan Gosling's character is a musician. Michael Fassbender plays a music exec, a shady music exec. And then you have other characters who kind of pass in and out, like Natalie Portman and Kate Blanchett is in there, and I think Berenice Bejo was in there. Or no, it was Berenice Marlowe. I always get this suit mixed up. And they all kind of just pass through but don't make any sort of impression. But none of the characters do, because Malick at this point is about making mood poems rather than stories. He doesn't have a narrative to tell anymore. And this is sort of his thing. It's been his thing since The Tree of Life. And I understand, you know, Tree of Life was a wildly successful movie. People really took to it. But it was also one of those movies that people could sort of put their own impression on it. It could be whatever somebody wanted it to be. If you wanted it to be a movie that was, you know, religious and spiritual, you could make it so. If you wanted to make it, if you in your mind you saw it as a movie that was about fathers and sons and the bond between them, well, you could make it so. If you wanted to see it as a movie that was about the universe and evolution of life in the universe, well, you could make it so. But it was actually none of those things. That was the problem with The Tree of Life. Yeah, it was gorgeous. It was a beautifully shot movie, like all of Malick's movies are. They're all beautiful. And Song to Song is shot beautifully, too. You know, Knight of Cups is shot beautifully. To the Wonder is shot beautifully. These are all atrocious movies that look great. And, you know, I feel like Malick has let himself get caught in a rut. I think the success of Tree of Life has emboldened him to make what I called essentially the same movies and the same B-roll footage he's been using for years, which is of celebrities prancing around on beaches and hugging one another and groping one another, but not actually saying or doing anything to progress a story. And Song to Song is odd in the sense that rather than having them prance along on beaches, now they're in underpasses, which is like, I guess that's changing things up for Malick. And there's a weird fascination with Rooney Mara's belly button. Everybody seems to be either touching it or kissing it or sniffing it, which is weird, but whatever. But I've grown tired of Malick. I'm through watching these movies. And I think if there's something good that's come out of Song to Song, and there's not much that's good that's come out of it, but there's one thing. It's that now I feel like I can finally put Malick to bed. Like, I don't need to watch another Terrence Malick movie. I've struggled through the last, four of them in a row, and they've all ended up on my worst of the year lists, all of them. And Song to Song is going to end up on my worst list for this year already, I can tell you that. So I think at this point I can start passing these movies along to somebody else to do. Somebody else can suffer through these things, or if they like them, because there are a couple of people who on Punch Drunk Critics who actually like Malick. They like this crap that he does. But me, I'm done. I'm phoning it in. I'm calling it a day. No more Malick for me. All right, I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we got news, we got Blu-rays, and we're going to wrap up the show, and I'll see you on the other side. Bye. we're back. Let's talk about what's coming out on Blu-ray. This will be next Tuesday, March 28th. And there is a, oh my God, my Amazon shopping list is about to burst. There's a bunch of movies here that I need to add to it. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them comes out on Tuesday. I love this movie. I was not the biggest Harry Potter fan, but Fantastic Beasts has kind of renewed my interest in the whole thing. I've started reading the books because of Fantastic Beasts. I've started reading the books, and I love this movie, and I'm curious to see where it goes, because it doesn't seem like these movies are going to stick to a specific formula, and it doesn't seem like they're going to be following all the same characters. Like, I don't think Eddie Redmayne's character is going to be central to the next one. So I'm curious to see where these things go. I'm actually kind of excited to see where they go. Martin Scorsese's long-awaited 20-year odyssey, Silence, comes out on Tuesday. This is a movie that did absolutely nothing on the awards circuit, which I thought was surprising in a way. I thought this was a really great film, one that's really thought-provoking. The problem with it is that there was never going to be an audience for this movie other than Scorsese diehards. You're talking about a film that's about two Jesuit priests who go to Japan to spread the gospel, basically. And it's a dark, foreboding movie. It's not even really, I don't even know if I could call it as called entertainment. It's a movie that's meant to make you think. So Silence is never going to have a big audience, but I think even by those standards, this is really, really low on in terms of what it made at the box office. I'm not so sure it made even $10 million at the box office, which makes me want to go and look it up now, like how much it actually did make. I'm pretty sure it didn't make much. But you're talking about a movie that Scorsese's been trying to make for 20, 30 years, and then have it come out and just kind of breeze in and out of the theaters like it was nothing. Yeah, it made $7 million worldwide. That's a Martin Scorsese movie. That's insane. But it just did not look appealing. You know, nobody was going to go see it. And that's despite having a cast that included Liam Neeson, Andrew Garfield, and Adam Driver. Nobody was going to pay for that. So, but to me, it is still a great movie and an essential piece to Scorsese's career. So, yes, I'll be owning that one. Or at least I will own it. It will go on my shopping list, and it will eventually get bought like everything else, like the other 50 things on my shopping list that I can't afford to get. Patriots Day. This is the Mark Wahlberg film that's about the Boston Marathon bombing. This was the second underrated Mark Wahlberg movie of last year, the other one being Deepwater Horizon. I don't know. I think people are maybe have had their fill of these true disaster tales. Nobody went to see Deepwater Horizon, which is crazy disappointing because it was such a good movie. And Patriots Day was really good as well. Had J.K. Simmons in it, John Goodman. A lot of people were in that movie. And I think both of those films did a good job. They're both done by Peter Berg, by the way. Both those movies did a really good job of focusing on the heroes of those events. Not just the disaster and the tragedy of it, but the people who helped try to make things better. So I wish more people had gone to see Patriots Day. I didn't necessarily think it was going to do well during the award season. I don't know why they felt they needed to put it out during the award season. But, yeah, it only made $44 million. $31 million domestic. So, yeah, it's not a good year for movies like that. What else? A Monster Calls. Wow. This one was another movie with Liam Neeson in it. This was the one directed by J.A. Bayona, who did The Impossible. He's doing Jurassic World 2. This was about the boy whose mother is dying of terminal illness, and he tries to cope with it basically by conjuring up a giant tree monster voiced by Liam Neeson. And this monster teaches him lessons on how to grow up and deal with his pain. It's a phenomenal movie. I think it's probably one of the best reviewed movies of 2016. It's definitely worth checking out. That's another one that I definitely want to own. 20th Century Women, which starred Annette Bening and my girl Greta Gerwig, Elle Fanning as well. This is the latest film from the guy who did Beginners. And I always forget his name. Every single time it comes up, I forget his name. And I just forgot it again. So whatever. I can't remember what that guy's name. Mike Mills. It's such a basic name. I always forget it. Yeah, Mike Mills. So 20th Century Women, another one that's worth checking out. I don't know if I own that one, but you should see it for the performances by Annette Bening and Greta Gerwig and Elle Fanning, who are tremendous. One movie that you probably don't need to own is Why Him? This is the comedy that starred James Franco and Bryan Cranston. Sort of a meet the parents type thing, where James Franco's character is like a rich billionaire, like an eccentric rich guy or something. Yeah, it looked awful and I didn't see it. So, and then The Handmaiden, which is one of my favorite foreign films of last year. I don't even know how to really describe it. It's directed by Park Chan-wook, who did Old Boy and things like that. And it's, I don't know how to describe The Handmaiden. I don't think I can describe The Handmaiden in just a few words. So I'm not even going to try. So The Handmaiden is one you definitely want to check out too, though. You should probably rent it first, though. It's probably not going to be for everybody. There's some kinky stuff in there. There's some violent stuff in there. So I probably wouldn't recommend buying it right straight away. But that's one to look into as well. All right, let's go into news real quick. A lot of news this week that caught my attention. And I got to rip on Sony for a minute, too. So let me just go ahead and start off with that, because I did mention it earlier. But Sony is working on a Black Cat Silver Sable team-up movie, which, one, it sounds like a really shitty idea. But, two, it's essentially the same sort of idea they had back when they had Spider-Man originally. Now, remember Spider-Man, they tried their last Spider-Man franchise, The Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield. And after the disaster that was The Amazing Spider-Man 2, they struck a deal with Marvel to sort of share the character, allowing him to go over to the Marvel Cinematic Universe to hang out with the Avengers. And that got everybody excited about Spider-Man again. He is still Sony's character on the big screen. But they have this deal with Marvel now that they're essentially sharing them. So Sony's new plan is to start another cinematic universe with Spider-Man characters, but no Spider-Man. So we saw them greenlight a Venom movie with no Spider-Man, and now a Black Cat Silver Sable movie with no Spider-Man. That sounds awful. But the problem Sony had with Spider-Man last time is that they began making all these big plans, these big franchise plans, these big plans before they had decent movies. So Amazing Spider-Man 2 was essentially a movie that was designed to set up everything else. And it was a disaster as a result because there was no good story in Amazing Spider-Man 2. It was too busy trying to lay the foundation for crossovers. It sounds like they're doing this kind of crap again. Why are they talking about a Black Cat Silver Sable movie now? They don't have anything. They have nothing. Why are they planning a Venom movie? Now, Venom's going to be the launching pad for the franchise. Okay, that's one thing. But how about getting that off the ground first? How about seeing if people actually like that movie? How about seeing if people actually want to see more of that universe before you start making other plans? This is exactly what got them into trouble before. And now they're doing it all over again. I don't know what Sony's thinking, but I see this as them making the same mistakes. So if this whole thing falls apart, look, I told you about it here first. All right, what else? Robert Rodriguez, he's going to be directing the Escape from New York remake. Hollywood's been trying to make Escape from New York forever, and it looks like it might be happening now. Now, then again, it looked like it was going to happen 3 years ago or 4 years ago or 5 years ago. It always looks like it's about to happen. This is, of course, based on the classic John Carpenter movie that starred Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken. Carpenter is going to have a hand in this movie too, working as sort of a consultant and an exec producer. So at least he'll be a part of it. We don't know who played Pliskin yet. That's going to be the key thing. I remember Joel Silver went to Charlie Hunnam a few years ago for a trilogy, which would have been interesting. But who knows what Robert Rodriguez is going to do. He'll probably pick somebody from his stable of actors that we've seen before. Maybe Clive Owen. That would be a good pick. So they want this to be a franchise, of course. Now they say, quoting, that it will be follow the same path as their successful Planet of the Apes franchise over at 20th Century Fox. I don't know if that means they want to do prequels or not, but that's kind of what it sounds like to me. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is going to be directing Channing Tatum in Wingmen, which is the R-rated musical comedy that they were attached to last year. Only now Levitt is going to be directing and starring in it. I think this sounds amazing just because both of them are so incredibly talented at pretty much everything they do, whether it's comedy or musicals or dancing or whatever. These guys can tear the house down. So I am excited to see how this goes. And they've worked together multiple times. We forget that that Channing Tatum was in Levitt's directorial debut, Don John, which I think is a movie that people have kind of forgotten about also. And they were also together in G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. Yeah. So, oh, and Havoc. And Havoc, yeah. They were in Havoc, too. That was the movie where Anne Hathaway showed her boobs. So, yeah. So these guys have a happy history. Netflix has extended their deal with Adam Sandler. Now, okay. Before you ask me why in the world would they extend their deal with Adam Sandler, and they're extending it for another four movies, by the way, another four movie exclusive deal, just like the last one. They're not even done with the last one yet. They've only completed three out of that four, and they're already extending it for another four. Before you ask me why they would bother doing that when all those movies are so awful, and they are awful, it's because those are the most popular movies Netflix has. Believe it or not, The Ridiculous Six, it's an embarrassment of a film. But it's one of the most watched movies Netflix has. The Do-Over is so bad and so insulting to women. It is disgusting. But people watch it. And people will probably watch Sandler's next movie, Sandy Wexler, which is the one where he's like an agent, a Hollywood agent in the 1990s. It looks terrible. But will people watch it? Yes. So that's why Netflix is doing this. Look, think about it this way. At least these movies won't be in theaters. So they won't be taking up space at your local multiplex. So look at the bright side. And finally, our buddy Brett Ratner. Brett Ratner, the guy who's directed a bunch of Rush Hour movies. He directed the worst X-Men movie, The Last Stand. He also directed Tower Heist. Yeah, I bet you forgot about that one. Or tried to forget about that one. And he also directed Hercules, which is the worst Dwayne Johnson movie ever. That guy, he doesn't like Rotten Tomatoes. He doesn't like their rating system. He says it hurts the business. Let's quote him here. "The worst thing that we have in today's movie culture is Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's the destruction of our business. I have such respect and admiration for film criticism. When I was growing up, film criticism was a real art, and there was intellect that went into it. And you would read Pauline Kael's reviews or some others, and that doesn't exist anymore. Now it's about a number, a compounded number of how many positives versus negatives. Now it's about, what's your Rotten Tomatoes score? And that's sad, because the Rotten Tomatoes score was so low on Batman vs. Superman, I think it put a cloud over a movie that was incredibly successful. People don't realize what goes into making a movie like that. It's mind-blowing. It's just insane. It's hurting the business. It's getting people to not see a movie. It's middle America. It's low Rotten Tomatoes score, so I'm not going to see it because it must suck. But that number is an aggregate and one that nobody can figure out exactly what it means. And it's not always correct. I've seen some great movies with really abysmal Rotten Tomatoes scores. What's sad is film criticism has disappeared. It's really sad." Okay. Now, I'm going to take sort of a middle-of-the-road approach here in this, because Ratner is partially right and partially wrong. He's right that Rotten Tomatoes Rotten Tomatoes really did hurt Batman vs. Superman. And the reason why he's focusing on that is because his company, Rat Pack, did some financing on Batman vs. Superman. So that's why he's talking about that movie specifically. And I agree with him. The score on Batman vs. Superman, the Rotten Tomatoes score, which is really, really low, at least on the critic side, really, really killed that movie, or at least hurt it. I mean, the movie still made about $800 million, so it didn't hurt it that much. The movie was still successful. But what it did was get everybody talking about how DC films all suck. And that carried over into Suicide Squad. People were comparing Suicide Squad to Batman vs. Superman before Suicide Squad even come out. So that's what it's done. And he's right about that. There's no denying it. The general audience score for Batman vs. Superman is much higher than the critic score is. But nobody talks about the general audience score. They only talk about the critic score. That's the way Rotten Tomatoes works. Anytime a score is mentioned, it's the critic score. And look, I'm a critic on Rotten Tomatoes, so I contribute to that, and I can still admit it and say that it's not fair. And he's right in a sense that Rotten Tomatoes has made it so that we look at a movie now and we just base on whether it's good or not on its Rotten Tomatoes score. Oh, the movie has 50% on Rotten Tomatoes, it must suck. And that's true. A lot of people do that. Now, when people talk to me, and they do it all the time, and they say, you know, Travis, thank you for steering me away from this movie or so forth, I always say, don't just listen to me. Go judge for yourself. Because that's what I want. I mean, that's just my opinion. It doesn't mean it's the opinion. It's my opinion. And my opinion might be different than yours. We like different things. I always say, if a movie looks interesting to you, go see it. Don't just listen to me. I might have my head stuck up my ass. And who knows? You just go see the movie and decide for yourself whether or not you thought it was good or bad. Now, where he's wrong is in making it seem as if this is all Rotten Tomatoes' fault. Yes, they use a number system, and the aggregate, the system is fairly straightforward. At least the number is fairly straightforward on the critic side. It's the basic. If there are 10 critics who review a movie, and 6 of them give it a positive, a thumbs up score, then it's got a 60% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's any asshat can figure that out. That's easy. It's not that difficult to figure out. But let's keep it real. Every reviewer reduces their reviews in some way to a score. Or a symbol, or something. I mean, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, they use thumbs up, thumbs down. It doesn't get more simple than that. And these are arguably the two most respected critics in history. So we all want to make our reviews easy to understand and easy for people to figure out. So Ratner's wrong in making it seem as if Rotten Tomatoes is the only one that are doing this, or that this is some new phenomenon. It's not. It's always been this way. Film criticism has always been this way. And you can still have scores and things like that and still have intelligent criticism. And I refer to Roger Ebert, who, like I said, had a thumbs up, thumbs down system on his TV show, and on his website had a scoring system. And he still gave us thought-provoking film reviews. So you can have both. And Ratner's trying to make it seem as if we can't. And he's wrong. So that's my thoughts on that. And that is basically it for news anyway. That's pretty much all I got. And there goes the outro music, which means I'm on my way out of here. Hope you enjoyed the show. This episode of Cinema Royale. I want to thank Jeff Lyles of Lyles Movie Files for coming on to talk about Power Rangers. We didn't descend to talk about wrestling this time, and that's good. That's usually what happens. So we avoided that this time. I want to thank all of you for tuning in as well. You can find Cinema Royale, of course, at blogtalkradio.com. You can also find it on punchdrunkcritics.com. You can find me at both of those spots. You can also find me on WETA Around Town on Channel 26 if you're here in D.C. on Thursday mornings on WBAL Morning News with Brian Neiman, and on Fridays, every other Friday, on News Channel 8 Midday, which I'll be on there this week, probably talking about Ghost in the Shell. which is the movie that we'll be talking about on Cinema Royale next week. And they're not screening that for us, which has me worried. Which means I'll be paying to see it on Thursday night with everybody else. Fun. That concerns me. Anytime they don't screen a movie, like they didn't screen Chips this week. That movie sucks. I already know it does. That didn't do well at the box office either. See, that's where film criticism can help you. Sometimes they think that, oh, well, we won't screen a movie because, you know, reviews won't kill it. Well, no. Most people know if you don't screen a movie, that means you have no confidence in it. So studios need to be wary when they do that. Anyway, this has been Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson, the Punch Drunk Critics. I will see you next week. Goodbye.